for 90.1 FM KKFI. I'm Mark Manning. Thank you so much for listening.
The party's over now. The dawn is drawing very nigh. Let's creep away from the day and allow me to say goodbye.
And you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's 12 noon. It's now time for All Souls Forum.
Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Today's program features Katie Booty, and she is going to talk about Kansas City school reform from the inside. And we've got question and answer period coming up as usual, and we'll have our introduction as usual, too. This program was recorded on Sunday, April the 20th of 2014 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Let's go right to our introduction, and we'll get things underway.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the forum at All Souls. We have been doing this weekly since 1943, September through May, so we've had a long history. And one of the topics that comes up over and over and over again is the whole situation about education. Last week, Bill Mullins, who's sitting up here, gave a very thoughtful forum talking about computational thinking and mindful computing, and raised a number of very good issues. He's invited our speaker for today, and I'm going to turn things over to him to introduce our speaker.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming out on Easter morning. Joyous resurrection to everyone. As Carolyn mentioned last week, I talked at some length about computation and all the modern technology in relation to particularly education, some things I observed in charter schools and very young children. And I think, I hope at least, that this will be a segue for today's discussion, which perhaps will be a little more broad, but at the same time represents a personal narrative. And I've only known Katie for a few months personally, but the first time I met her, I pretty much recognized the kindred spirit because she's all about engagement and expansive engagement. We know that access to broadband technology and thinking and knowledge is important, but we tend to not quite yet understand what engagement is all about. I talked last week a little bit about this toy model that I use that identifies the fact that we live in a networked world, that our horizons, whether we realize it or not, don't go on indefinitely like a map. They go around and they reconnect with themselves. I talked about the importance of understanding how race and gender and age and something I call corporatism fits into making sense out of all the gradients of equality and inequality. I got involved with education in the Kansas City public schools or urban education in general in 2009, and I've done a whole bunch of different things ever since. And when I met Katie, I realized that we had some nodes that we had crossed in common, and there were ways in which our journey had differed. And so I'm looking forward to hearing about her story. What I know about it, I think, will definitely lead us to a better understanding, particularly amongst those of us who are of a certain generation. I guess the challenge I would put out there is to ask yourself, how might we think about engaging with younger people who are doing the kind of things that Katie's doing?
All right. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out on Easter Sunday. I know it's beautiful out there as well, so I appreciate you coming in, and it's an honor to be here. My name's Katie Booty, and I've been working in education in Kansas City, specifically in public education, since 2008. But my story goes back longer than that in Kansas City, so thank you for letting me share it with you today. So I'm going to ask you to consider education's role in the broader ecosystem of Kansas City for today, and also consider your role as an individual and your own history as a Kansas Cityan, and what role that plays in our whole city's fabric overall. And back up all the way to the beginning of September in 1867, when Kansas City Public Schools were born. a little known fact maybe, but that public schools in Kansas City began in rented office space with just 16 teachers and one superintendent before they built the first two school buildings, one of which is pictured here, which was the Hawthorne Building on 12th and Locust, now where City Hall and our jail are. Might be a fitting metaphor or not. And that's really where Kansas City Public Schools began. My history with Kansas City Public Schools in general starts on my paternal side, and I just pick that side because my mom's from, she's right here, she's from Puerto Rico and New York, so she wasn't quite here through this lineage. But my great-grandfather, Benjamin Booty, is the first lineage of we know of our family being in Kansas City. And by 1910, that family had built a family corner store and a sixplex on East 35th Street on the corner of 35th and Flora. It still stands today. Both buildings do. And during this time, from 1867 to 1910, Kansas City had gone through huge changes. Population boundaries were expanding. During this time, 34 square miles are added, and rapid school expansion occurs. And here is a picture of the store as it stands today. It's no longer in use, hasn't been for a few decades. I promise this comes full circle. At this time, around when the time the store was built in 1910, 2 years later, the school board expands. As you can see, it's all white men at this time, prominent white men at that time as well. 1916, my grandfather is born at the sixplex right next door to the store. He ends up becoming a doctor after graduating from Westport High School. And then my dad, who's right here, is born in 1950. At this time, as many of you guys know, white flight begins to occur. He's born in Kansas City, Missouri, and I thought this statistics interesting, but between 1958 and 1973, 60,000 white people move from the urban core of Kansas City, and those homes are replaced by African American families at almost a duplicative rate. My family ends up moving to South Kansas City and then to Johnson County, Kansas, and my dad graduates from Shawnee Mission North High School and then KU. At the same year, my dad graduates from KU in 1968, just around the corner from my great-grandfather's and my grandfather's corner store and sixplex. C.A. Franklin is built. It's during the modernist school movement. We're about 10 years behind the coast in this in Kansas City, and we build a series of schools that have more modern boundaries that are pushing what the traditional school system looks like. One of these is C.A. Franklin, which was built as an open classroom concept. By this time, this neighborhood is predominantly African American, and by the time C.A. Franklin opens, most of its students are as well. You can see here, it's completely open. There's no walls, really, partition walls. There's areas where students can collaborate, teachers can collaborate. And this is actually the first school I taught at in 2008 when I came back to Kansas City. My story where I come in the picture, my dad, after graduating from KU, moves to New York City. My brother's born in 1980 in New York City. And my parents, fearful for the public education that existed in New York City at the time, decide to move back to Kansas, where my dad's from, to provide us, I wasn't in the picture yet again, a better education. So during this time, however, when they moved to Prairie Village, Kansas in 1983, the desegregation remedy orders begin to take place in 85. The magnet schools start opening. We see a lot of reforms start happening in the Kansas City, Missouri school district at that time. That occurs through 1995 through the closing of the Missouri v. Jenkins case. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that era. In 1987, I'm born right in the middle of all of that. My brother and I have the pleasure of going to or the privilege of going to Shawnee Mission Schools. I graduated from Shawnee Mission East. And then I move out of state to Washington State, actually on an education scholarship. And in 2008, Teach for America opens its first region in Kansas City. And ironically, I end up at C.A. Franklin Elementary School,
which is literally, if you can see, I'll bump back, a less than 4-minute walk. The circle's where my great-grandfather's store was, my grandfather's apartment building, and we're literally kitty corners where I end up teaching my first year. So to back up, at this point in time, though, a lot had changed in Kansas City. When I showed up at C.A. Franklin in 2008, only 7% of our kids were on grade level, and K through 6 in reading and math, meaning that if you're basic or below basic, you're at least 2 years behind, meaning that 93% of our kids were at least 2 years behind in subject areas. We were 99% African American, 99% free and reduced lunch. At this point in time, also, we were not under Covington. We were under provisional accreditation at that time, and we had an interim superintendent. During this time, they had decided to close all of the middle schools, and they were doing this, phasing it out in a two-year plan. So the first year, they had eighth-grade centers, and that was in 2008, 2009 when I showed up to teach. My assignment was sixth grade math, seventh grade math, and a sixth grade remedial reading class. Over the next year, we saw drastic school reductions. All the eighth grade centers were closed, and we saw drastic teacher cuts. Again, this is before right-sizing. By my second year of teaching, we had eliminated all the middle schools, put all the middle schools into a K-8 setting with no structure. That school, C.A. Franklin, the pictures of the open classroom concept, none of the facilities had been updated since 1968. So you still have all those open concepts, open walls. However, you're moving an entire middle school into that setting. And myself and two other 22-year-old Teach for America Corps members were orchestrating that whole move with very little experience and a lot of trial and error. So it was pretty rough. By the second year after teacher reductions, I ended up teaching sixth grade math, seventh grade math, eighth grade math, sixth grade social studies, sixth grade reading, and was the middle school administrator, which was not a good model. I don't advise anyone replicating that. Our scores did go up, though. We did see 10% gains. And quickly thereafter, that whole order of moving the middle schools into the K-8 settings was completely reversed. So we had done all this work to move this in. And under right-sizing, when Covington came in, he decided to go through the 7-12 model. So we knew that this change was coming. In 2009 as well, C.A. Franklin was ordered to close when right-sizing went through under Dr. Covington, and 40% of our schools were closed for fiduciary purposes. It was also a chronically underperforming school. But before that, I want to walk you through some of my students' stories from that time. I'll tell you about three students, Daniel, Kaisa, and DeAndre, who are all very, very different. Daniel, on the left, he was in my homeroom, and I met him the first day of teaching and when he was in sixth grade. And the first couple days I met Daniel, it was very apparent that he was very bright, a really good reader, really strong writer. And about the second week into school, he walked into my classroom, and something was very amiss. He recoiled to the back of the classroom, pretty much completely shut down. And this was a kid that was very, very gregarious, very outgoing, very popular. He had witnessed his brother get murdered in his front yard the day before. And because we had a counselor that only showed up every other week for one day a week, had no one to talk to. So Daniel spent 1 month, they were supposed to rotate classes. Daniel spent 1 month just in my classroom sitting through four different classes of the same math class every single day because he didn't want to leave, because he had no one to really talk to, and that was secure for him. And that's Jonathan on the right, who was a good student. Daniel today started at Southwest Early College campus for high school. His sister got custody of him, and after the turmoil going on at SWEC, elected to move him into the Hickman Middle School District, where he is currently a junior. Other two students, Kaisa and DeAndre. Kaisa is a small girl on the left, and Kaisa was an exceptional student. She stuck out to me because around this time, we started hosting Saturday schools at a local church and community center. and because our kids were so far behind. And Kaisa's mother would actually come with her every single Saturday to learn skills right next to her so that she could get to the level that Kaisa was at so she could help Kaisa graduate from college. Kaisa is also a junior at Southwest Early College campus right now. DeAndre, the guy with the fro in the back, was my top student. He was also a rapper and lyricist. By the time he was in eighth grade, he had recorded 3 albums on his own. Really, really bright student from a family of 5, oldest kid. He's also a senior at Southwest Early College campus. And I just bring these up because I think oftentimes we see the news about SWEC and forget that there are individual people there, that kids that are really, really bright and have worked really, really hard. We did have the luxury of being able to put together a newspaper that we were able to print. C.A. Franklin was named after Chester Arthur Franklin, who was the founder of the Call newspaper. So in his legacy, my students decided to put together their own student newspaper and print it and distribute it to the community as a voice of the students themselves and start highlighting in the community the good work the kids were doing. So there's 3 of my students, Jaleesa, Daisha, and Monet, with their papers. And then Dr. Covington, in 2010, of course, our school gets closed. So at this point in time, I was a Teach for America core member, like I said, and this was, in my core, we had brought in 50 Teach for America core members, and all of us, except for 2, were in Kansas City Public Schools. 2 others were at a charter school. Under right-sizing, every single one of us, all 48 of us that were in the district, did get pink slipped, so we were non-renewed to teach at any of the schools in the district. So I was lucky enough to find a job at a different school in Kansas City, at a charter school. Unfortunately, many of my peers who were excellent teachers ended up leaving the profession or leaving the city altogether because of unstable opportunities. So I end up as a founding teacher at Alta Vista Charter Middle School, completely different demographic on the west side of Kansas City. The middle school opened up at 1711 Broadway. It's now at 1722 Holly Street. Got the experience of being a founding middle school teacher again. To follow my father's footsteps again, just kind of funny where it is on the map. My parents ended up as social workers doing work in the city here. My dad ended up doing a lot of community organizing around 1829 Madison, where that dot is. And then if you follow the arrows, the middle ones where my house is, and we just went up the street. So this whole time I've been working in very, very close communities to where I either had roots or my parents did work. Very similar school in a lot of ways when we walked into it. Again, when we opened the school in 2010, only 7% of our kids were on grade level, although from a different demographic. 90% of our kids at this school are ESL kids, the English is their second language. Many of them are immigrants or second-generation Latino kids. I'll also tell you a couple stories about them as well. I have the privilege now of working part-time at the high school, so these kids have been able to follow since they were in sixth grade directly, and I see them every day, and I now see them at the high school every day. One of them is Jackie Lavario, and Jackie started out as one of those kids, one of the 93% that were not on grade level, significantly behind in math. Really low confidence in math. By the end of the 2 years, she's now at the high school. She's on track. She's proficient, and she's on track to be college ready. And she comes in every Saturday to math tutoring, and she knows what her predicted ACT score is, and she's right on the right path. Another success story is Cesar. Cesar came to us when he was in seventh grade. He had been in the United States for 4 years already, and he was in an ESL program in the district. By the time he came to us in seventh grade, he still spoke very, very little English. He was pretty much illiterate in English and could write very few words in English as well. Within 2 years, within 3 years now, he's now a sophomore, he's completely caught up to grade level in English, and it works really, really hard, is also on track to be in college. Another kid, though, is Prince, who's one of the sweetest kids ever. He works with Boys Grow, so if you ever see that organization around town, you might see him talking about the ketchup and different things that they're making. Prince and his brother are severely dyslexic and dysgraphic. Unfortunately, one of the hurdles we have is that we have really unstable special ed services, both in the district and in the charter sector in Kansas City. So Prince has not been able to receive special ed services that were adequate until the last 2 years. And we're still putting together a really great plan that could help him combat that. Unfortunately, at this time right now, though, and this is just, I put him up here because this is the reality for many Kansas City kids. We don't have the robust services that are adequate enough to get him where he needs to be so that he could be on track to attain college readiness. All right, so this is kind of where I'm going to open it up to you guys. And this is where we are today and where my work's transitioned. So I started out in the classroom the last 3 years. I worked at Alta Vista in the classroom as well. I then transitioned to an instructional coach, which just means that I was helping other teachers better their instructional practice and their curriculum. And then I decided to go back to school again to pursue my leadership degree in administration. And I worked for a principal over the summer and decided I hated it. So I reevaluated my life a little bit. It's a really hard job, God bless them, but not for me. And then I kept coming back to this idea of Kansas City as a whole. And this is where I started running into people like Bill and this idea of Kansas City as an ecosystem and where education plays a role. Although, obviously, if you guys have been reading the papers, education's had significant challenges, especially this last year, especially these last few months with the C-Trust and the unaccredited status. Since I moved back to Kansas City in 2008, we've seen a tremendous amount of progress. Even if you just look at the landscape with the Kauffman Center, it's different. It's more vibrant. We've had so many more entrepreneurial communities and companies move to Kansas City. There's been a lot of momentum built in the entrepreneurial and arts communities. So part of my job and part of my fascination now has been, how can two sectors start blossoming while one stays so stagnant? And what are they doing that we're not doing in education? So I started just going to events, and this is where kind of my re-education as an educator started happening. I started going to events and the arts community, which wasn't too far out of my comfort zone. And then I started going to events in the startup tech community, which was completely out of my comfort zone, talking to people who code on computers all day, and their bottom line is very much money, where mine hasn't been. And that really opened my eyes because I realized the way that they were able to galvanize change and grow their communities was really just by being connected as a community. They would hold just simple meetups where over a beer, one of them would share a success story from the week, and they would learn things like how to use better marketing strategies or how to use social media to really push out your message and increase your users. None of that community exists or existed then in education in Kansas City. There is nowhere to go in Kansas City if you're a teacher that had a really great lesson this week and you just want to share those resources. Or on the opposite side, there's nowhere to go if you're a teacher that had a really bad day or a really challenging student and talk about what you could do to make that better. And in both the arts and entrepreneurial communities, there very much are. You can just Google meetups and you'll find them. So we started playing with this idea, myself and some other neighbors and other teachers, of how can we build that kind of community. And that's what's led me to my work today at the Lean Lab, which is what we call ourselves as an organization. And simply all we've been doing is hosting pop-up events around town, getting people together to share their successes and also share their problems and start talking about how can we brainstorm and solve these problems as a community. And that's what we do. We just talk about how can we solve these problems together. Because, yes, we've had a lot of, I think especially the narrative over the last year, has been very much highlighting the challenge and the struggle, but not so much taking the next step of talking about what can we actually do as individuals that have ties and histories, whether they're direct or indirect, to the education in our city. And that's it. So I'm just going to open it up to you guys, question and answer.
You're listening to educator Katie Booty, and she's talking about school reform, how it looks from the inside. This program was recorded on April the 20th of 2014. Hope you're enjoying it so far. Stay tuned for the question and answer period, wherein she takes questions from the audience. We owe you a few messages, however. Let's do those right now, and we'll come back and start right with the questions. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Bike for Peace from Norway will bicycle through Kansas City, Missouri, and Independence this week in a world tour to see a nuclear weapon-free world by 2020. On Wednesday at 6 p.m., All Souls Unitarian holds a free supper for all to welcome Bike for Peace. That's at 4501 Walnut. On Thursday at 11 a.m., the day will be declared Bike for Peace Day in Kansas City at City Hall in the lobby. At 1 p.m. Thursday, local bikers join Bike for Peace in a 7-mile bike ride from Parade Park at Paseo and Truman Road to Community of Christ Temple, where there will be a huge peace rally from 3 to 4 p.m. For information, contact PeaceWorks 913-206-4088. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This Friday, May 2nd at Unity on the Plaza, a benefit for KKFI. It's the Pete Seeger Memorial Birthday Concert. Starts at 7:30 p.m. featuring Danny Cox, Bob and Diana Sukiel, Madison Ward and the Mama Bear, Maria Vasquez Boyd, Casey Roush, Howard Iceberg and Emily Timmons, David Haken, Jason Beers, and hosted by me, that's Betsy Ellis. And I hope you'll join us there for the Pete Seeger Memorial Birthday Concert. You can go to kkfi.org for more information and a link to tickets, which are at Brown Paper Tickets. Tickets available in advance and also at the door. That's this Friday, May 2nd, the Pete Seeger Memorial Birthday Concert at Unity on the Plaza, a benefit for KKFI.
An interview with Dr. Tyrone Hayes. He is an American biologist and professor of integrated biology at the University of California near Berkeley and is known for his research findings that the herbicide atrazine emasculates and feminizes male frogs. Hear his story on Sprouts Thursday at noon.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, a cauldron of troublemakers, the Labor Notes Convention, with speeches by new APWU President Mark Diamondstein, Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis, and rank-and-file troublemakers, too. Tune in. The Heartland Labor Forum, Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Junk food comprises a third of American daily calories. We eat crap a third of the time each and every day. Think about kids' tantrums. What we oftentimes find with those children is it's actually not a behavioral problem. It's a blood sugar crash that they have no control over.
Join us this week when our guest will be Maggie Adamek. It's Kicking the Habit, Sugar, Fat, and Junk Food Junkies on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before
Hindu Village Goddesses on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30, just before Every Woman.
Hello, thank you for coming to talk to us today. I have never had a child in the Kansas City system. I've lived here 15 years. My children were already grown and out of the house when I came here. And all I know about the school system is what I read in the Star. When you asked the question a minute ago, why has education stayed so static while others grew? And, of course, technology and the meetups, I know, is what you found that will help your situation from the inside. But when I read the Star, after having read the Star all these years, I've come to the conclusion that currently Kansas City cannot fix its own school system itself, and, you know, administratively, politically, and why not let the state attempt to do it? So my question is, from your perspective on the inside, would it be a good thing for the state to take over control of our system? Or bad? Or what's your opinion?
My opinion is that no takeover. I mean, we need something radical, but no takeover will be effective unless we have a community that galvanizes support, unless we have absolutely committed, highly educated, impactful leaders, which unfortunately I don't think we have enough at the state level or the local level yet. However, if we start coming together and start cultivating that leadership, I think we can have some sort of radical change. But from the plans I saw submitted by the state from the takeover that's happened in the two St. Louis districts,
I have not seen any radical change that's benefited Kansas City or any kids in Missouri.
Since you've been on the inside of both systems, would you kind of contrast the charter school system with the public school system?
Yeah, the difference is, I will say the charter school system is much easier to move for through change. So one story I didn't tell about Alta Vista School is that our high school actually started as an alternative school in 1990. In 98, 99, it turned over to a charter school when charter school law was passed in the state of Missouri. It was still an alternative school. In those 20 years, though, since we've been open, Alta Vista is now the highest performing math department in the state. 100% of their Algebra 1 kids passed the EOC last year, with 73% of them being advanced, and 80% of them were admitted to at least two-year universities last year. And that happened because we were able to cultivate leadership from inside and have a very small system that we were able to control. So we were able to control teacher quality, teacher development, professional development, very, very intentionally, because it was a very small scale and didn't have to go through the red tape that you often see in the district. Also, because of that, we've been able to ensure stability in leadership, which has not happened in the district. You're working through a centralized HR department in the district, which means that oftentimes principals rotate, teachers often rotate. I'm not even going to get into teacher tenure law, because I don't think that's really where it starts. I think it really starts at the hiring and the support you're giving teachers in the classroom, which we have been able to control. So that's the big difference I see. That is therefore a hope.
So let's say that we have a really good, highly functioning school, but we also have kids with immense family problems these days. So could you comment a little bit about what you would see as a school's role in providing support services for families and students so that those students don't have 7 hours of really good instruction, but outside like a totally chaotic, uncoordinated life, so to speak?
Yeah, I think we've seen some really interesting social experiments take place. Harlem Children's Zone has provided, galvanized the energy of a whole entire, 23 square blocks to combat issues of poverty where everyone on, where social services are picking up where schools can't. I think one interesting thing going on in Kansas City that most people don't know about, at Woodland School in the Northeast, Jerry Kitsey, who used to work at the Kauffman Foundation and has worked in early childhood education, has opened the district's first ECE center that has all wraparound programs in it. So he's partnering with the YMCA, he's partnering with parents as teachers, he's partnering with early literacy programs and the public library to provide a hub for family support, not just instructional support for students. So I think we're seeing this start to happen in really interesting ways. I think we need to keep testing it and keep providing that support to see what can actually happen for those kids that don't have the traditional support at home that maybe other kids benefit from.
I want to hear more about this Lean Lab. As a former teacher, I'm very aware of the inability to really communicate in a structured school district-controlled school in order to communicate and learn, blah, 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 blah. I want to hear about that Lean Lab.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk more about it. What we do, I said, it's a pretty simple concept. We bring together educators, innovators, and grassroots leaders just to share problems and brainstorm solutions. So what that's looked like so far is we've had an innovation weekend, which was like a startup weekend. So people came together for a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday and worked on teams to create and launch solutions that would impact kids. We also had a parent and educator luncheon that did the same thing. We're also going to have just an educator event at the Kauffman Foundation on May 17th as well. And then this summer, we're launching a full incubator program where anyone, and it will be going live on our website on Monday, so if you're interested, check it out tomorrow, can apply to the program, and you'll go through a month of training where the hope is at the end you'll actually have a viable solution to launch in schools. So what that looks like, we're working with a woman who wants to use mindfulness to train teachers how to use mindfulness as a behavior management tool, so that when you're dealing with kids that have experienced significant trauma in their lives, such as Daniel, if I had known I could have a tool in my classroom to use to serve him so he could get back into other classes, that would have been a game changer for that kid. So we're trying to launch a solution so that that can happen for kids that have suffered similar traumas across the metro area. There's also, I mean, that's just one example. There's also other ideas out there. So it's really just a community of support to think about how can we disrupt the system, if you will, in a positive way, starting from the community. But yeah.
And the website is theleanlab.org up there, right?
It is.
Your mom and I are so proud of you, Katie.
Oh, God.
We love you.
This is my dad.
In case you didn't know. No, I do have a question. You talk about creating an educational community similar to the arts community and the startup community for business. We know that community has a lot to do with addressing the social concerns that a previous question addressed. What do you know about the creation or the stabilization of neighborhood communities, physical communities in Kansas City, particularly on the east side, and how does that overlap with what you're trying to do?
As far as community efforts to support schools on the east side?
Just stabilizing communities so that there's less crime, less trauma, more resources, things like that, that attends to those 20 or those 16 hours when the kids aren't in school.
Yeah, I think there's the Woodland School, like I talked about. I know Indian Mound 64123 Northeast zip code and neighborhood has been trying to get Promise Neighborhood off the ground, which is a replication process for Harlem Children's Zone. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens with the old Bancroft School and that whole redevelopment with the Urban Neighborhood Initiative. However, in southeast Kansas City, however, I haven't seen it done in a really cohesive way yet. And part of that problem is honestly that we have a school desert now on the east side, if you guys aren't aware of that. When Covington closed the schools in 2009, 2010, if you look at a map on Midtown East Side, which is actually where our highest needs communities are, there are pretty much no schools. They're central on the eastern boundary. Franklin was closed. That was all gone to Faxon at 31st and Paseo. And really that whole corridor that goes down to Hyde Park has no real public schools in it anymore. Westport was closed as well. So that's why you're now seeing there's a really interesting community initiative going on right now, though, to solve that. A group of parents that you might have read in the paper in Hyde Park put together the Midtown Community School RFP, and they put out an RFP trying to ask any school operator to come in and build a community school in that neighborhood because there just simply are none. And they were able to secure a contract with Citizens of the World Charter Schools, who are based in New York and L.A., who believe in diverse school settings that are project-based and galvanizing community support around a school. So that'll be really interesting to see if we can actually launch that as a community there, because, like I said, there really aren't many schools left on the east side, unfortunately.
Well, I started feeling some nostalgia when I saw the picture of where your store was. My daughter attended Franklin in 75-76. Andrea Dawson from the church, people all know that, was in that same class. And what the school district had done is when they opened up having a limited number of gifted and talented programs, they cited them primarily at some of the poorest schools and some of the schools, so that in the class where my daughter was, there were a mixture of some of the neighborhood kids who were especially bright, and there were also children who came bussed in from elsewhere. But as an example of the bonds that were formed in that class, they had a class reunion, it was about 3 years ago, of the 5th, 6th grade class from 75, 76, 77, and kids came from all around the country to come back. So sometimes there are positive things that we never ever hear about. Can you think of some other of the positive things that don't particularly make it into the media anywhere?
Yeah, actually, I'm really excited to announce or to talk about this. We just got a grant, the Lean Lab just got a grant from the Mozilla Firefox Gigabit Fund to do exactly that. It's called Project Bright Spots. And we're going to be launching a platform to share all the good things that are happening in Kansas City, because precisely right, we don't always hear about them. I think other than the success at Alta Vista, we know there's been a whole collaborative community called Esteem Village, which is bringing together educators and kids engaging in science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics. And they have created this whole robotics program, and I think they've won some now national and international awards. And it's really cool collaborations because it's happening between a private school, a charter school, a public school, and also involving homeschooled kids as well, and that also kind of southeastern boundaries. So that's just one example, but there are lots, and we're looking for them. So if you know any other stories like the reunion at CA Franklin, I'd love to hear about it.
Thank you so much to your parents. You're turning out okay. A couple of things. Esteem Village, just as a data point, in May, we will see the launch of a space experiment to the International Space Station that was developed as a part of the Esteem Village collaboration. And there will also be a day on May 8th where there will be an all-day effort or an opportunity for people to come and see a little more firsthand the kind of things that Katie's been talking about. I do have a question, and it concerns funding. Congratulations on the Mozilla grant. But I would be interested in what your thoughts are about the future of how we fund these starter initiatives and experiments, all of which are not going to turn out, you know, the way we had hoped, but that in the long run, if we develop the capacity to run the experiments, then I think we'll start to see that growing local control and neighborhoods being revitalized and so on. So from what experience you've had, what can you say about the future of how we should be funding these things?
I mean, I think we, as a country, we prioritize, like, venture capital has become a billion-dollar industry just over the last 10 years. Why are we not allocating that kind of money for education? So I think it takes a mindset shift, and I think it's in our mindsets and it's on our priorities as a populist base. You know, you think about all of the thousands and billions of transactions that happen every day. Money's going somewhere. Why are we choosing to not put it in, my opinion, our most valuable assets, our kids, and figuring out this system? So I think it's just, how do we change that conversation around around where our funding goes? That's, I think, where it starts. As far as, you know, how do we make that sustainable in the long term? I don't know yet, but I think the money is there. And we see, I mean, look at Harlem Children's Zone in New York. That's a billion-dollar nonprofit, mostly funded by the private sector. So how do we move that money into the sector of public good?
I don't mean this as a criticism, but I thought it might be helpful to mention it anyway. To begin with, I'd like to also thank you for coming here and giving us the benefit of the years of experience that you've had, and I want to compliment you on devoting your life to such a difficult challenge. But in terms of the presentation you're making today, I have the same problem I have with my daughter. You and she both talk a lot faster than I can listen. And so I would love to have been able to absorb more of the points that you made, and I'm not sure you may have covered it more than I thought you had, but I didn't hear much about the issue of testing, which is enormous. It may not have exactly the same definition of reform, meet the definition of reform that you came here to speak about today, but at the national level, there's tremendous debates going on. The teachers' union on one side, the federal administration on another, and then in many different school districts around the country, a lot of disagreements over whether it's possible to test a teacher's performance test children, in order to determine what kind of performance teachers are providing and whether they should be promoted or given salary increases and so forth. And so I thought from your experience, maybe you could give us some perspective on the value of testing, what type of testing, if any, should be done, and anything else you might have to say on that topic. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you for asking this question. No one's asked it in a while, which is kind of interesting. But
I and this is just my opinion, and like you said, this is a wildly divisive topic, so this is by in no ways may not hold water to your situation or your experience. But my opinion is that I have administered the MAP, the Missouri Assessment Program exams, 6 times now, and that test is not rigorous. I believe that every child should be able to do what's on that test. I believe it is a travesty that 70% of our kids cannot right now. Also, to only test proficient on the state exams, you only have to get about 60% correct. And 70% of our kids are not able to do that. So, one, I think that is unconscionable, and I think that's wrong. However, I do think we do need to have some sort of accountability metric that does tell us where our kids are and what our future looks like as a city. That being said, as a teacher that taught high stakes testing subjects my whole career so far, it's a tremendous amount of stress and it's not sustainable. So I think we should still have our bar up here. We should still measure where our kids are. But I think we need to radically restructure how schools look so that we can support kids to get there without burning out teachers, without misplacing blame and judgment on what's honestly an impossible task for one person to do over an entire career.
I think you've done a wonderful thing here. And I see where the Lean Lab gives an individual teacher an opportunity to maximize her effectiveness in a classroom. And if we get enough teachers doing this individually in their classrooms, it'll be a wonderful reform per classroom. But I imagine this idea just scares administration to death, people who want to be in control of every one of you. And then, of course, there are some teachers who just resist anything. Tell us, please, who's pushing back, if anyone, against your... I'm going to call it a movement. Who's pushing back, if anyone?
I would say there hasn't been a lot of pushback against us, per se, once people hear about it. I think the problem is that education is so incredibly divisive. People immediately want to put you in a camp. They want to say, oh, you're an ed reformer. You're for the privatization of all schools. You want to do away with the district. Or I've gotten both sides of the argument, or you're the opposite. You want to maintain the status quo and protect teachers, et cetera, et cetera. And when really we're neither. And that argument needs to be demolished. We need to quit talking in binary terms because it's not productive. So I think the pushback, if I've gotten any, has been trying to put us in one camp or the other, when really what we're saying is that those camps have to be destroyed and we have to start talking about solutions and move to the next stage of dialogue.
I was a strange child, and I didn't learn in school. And I learned very quickly that after 3 days of the first grade or second grade or third grade, that I wasn't taught anymore. I was just pushed aside and set in the hall or in the office. Do they do anything with those kind of children nowadays? And I learned many years later I had dyslexia. But do they do anything with those kind of children nowadays, or are they just pushed aside?
In our city, I haven't seen it done well, and that's why I bring up the story of Prince, because at scale, I have not seen it done well. So unfortunately, what we do see are far too many kids with disabilities or kids that just learn from different learning styles. In our city, I've seen this done well in the suburbs, unfortunately not here. I haven't seen it done really well at scale, and that's something that needs to be talked about and needs to be changed, absolutely. I think special education, like I said before, is something we absolutely have to develop more trained teachers and more trained leaders to meet all of our kids' needs, and we're not doing it well enough yet.
How can we diminish the amount of stress that's put on teachers and students in relation to preparation for testing, as well as just the overall picture within the classroom setting?
I think one thing you guys, anyone can do right now, if there's a local school in your neighborhood, think about things you can do that might take you just an hour or two a week and would change a teacher's entire day. If you can things I know that are always a daily grind are just making copies. I mean, you don't think about it, but I spent probably at least 1 hour making copies every single day, you know, 5 to 6 days a week. You multiply that over a month, over a year. That's a significant amount of time that could be dealing with kids that need extra attention, like you were talking about. So those kind of things can be things that you do right now. Also, I think, you know, developing relationships with teachers and just really starting to hear what their stressors are and how to relieve that. Is it sitting with a kid who might need more attention or who's more disruptive in that classroom? I think if we can really, you know, and that's something that's frustrating too. In suburban districts, we have full-time volunteer coordinators, people that come in and do this for kids that are not as high need. We don't have anything like that at scale in the urban core. So really, I mean, citizens do have power. It does make a huge difference. And it might seem silly, but something like making copies, collating paper, stapling, bulletin boards, those things really do help.
I really enjoyed hearing your specific stories about your students and just hearing the different ways that they were bright and the gains they had made. One of the things I'm curious about, though, is that it seemed like the measure for this success was that they were now college ready. And college is not the only path to success or stable life or good employment. And I guess I can imagine that from an educator's perspective, like that's a really high bar. And if somebody's ready to go to college, they're on track. But I'm just wondering, and I know if you're still working with a lot of middle school students, this may not be as much of an issue, but I'm wondering about career development and, you know, helping kids see that maybe they'd be a great electrician or, you know, they want to do vo-tech or they want to learn to be a plumber. Those are, you know, good, stable jobs, too.
Yeah, no, this is a really interesting debate. I think a lot of what we've seen in the education reform movement specific to high-performing charter schools across the country is this emphasis, and with Common Core, on college and career readiness. A lot of charter school, urban charter schools you'll see across the country have an overemphasis on college. You'll see banners everywhere. That is the kind of end-all, be-all, and I think it's something to challenge. What I do agree with, though, is that I do believe that every child has the right to be prepared for college. So if they do choose to do whatever they want to do, whether it be an electrician or their own business owner or an artist, that's not because they could not elect to go to a university.
Again, I'd like to thank Katie and her parents. Job well done, and appreciate everyone's questions. To ratify something she said about what citizens can do. And I talked a little bit last week about the difference between volunteering and acts of citizenship. I really think the call here is the one that says we have part of that duty of care that we can provide with our emotional and our physical presence that doesn't require funding. But when it starts to happen, it will cause good things to happen, and then the funds will flow to the good things. So I really appreciate the work that Katie's doing. I didn't get a chance to ask her if she would be available to chat in the library afterwards, but if she is, she'll be there. Thank you very much, and appreciate you.
You've been listening to Katie Booty talk about Kansas City school reform and how it looks from the inside, from the educator's point of view. And if you have children in school in Kansas City, I know this program was of interest to you. You can download this show if you didn't hear the entire show. It's available by podcast via the KKFI website at www.kkfi.org. This program is produced and edited for broadcast by Barry Lee. Thanks to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help each week in producing this program. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon for another All Souls Forum here on KKFI. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Race matters, resegregation, and the rollback of affirmative action. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With my weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast.
Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
So proclaimed Alabama Governor George Wallace more than half a century ago. His proudly racist rhetoric was matched by heinous actions, murders, lynchings, and systemic violence, often endorsed or organized by state and local governments, were inflicted on African Americans and their allies struggling for civil rights. Despite that, those fighting for equality prevailed. Among the successes were the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, affirmative action, and court-ordered integration of schools. But with this week's U.S. Supreme Court decision supporting Michigan's ban against affirmative action in state university admissions, and with the increasing resegregation of schools, it seems like Wallace's dream of segregation forever may be alive and all too well. Nicole Hannah-Jones is an investigative journalist with the nonprofit news organization ProPublica, which has just published her year-long 9,000-word piece on the resegregation of public schools in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. This remarkable report, Segregation Now, notes that in Tuscaloosa today, nearly one in three black students attends a school that looks as if Brown v. Board of Education never happened. The Brown decision, issued in May of 1954, covered several pending court cases, all organized by the NAACP, challenging school segregation. U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren authored the unanimous decision, writing, "We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal," he wrote. Hannah-Jones tells the history of school desegregation in Tuscaloosa through the lens of three generations of the Dent family. James Dent grew up in Jim Crow, Alabama, never sharing a classroom with a white student. His daughter, Melissa, first went to an integrated middle school in 1980. It had taken decades for Tuscaloosa to implement desegregation, and then only by additional court orders. The city's two high schools were consolidated into one, Central High, which became a state powerhouse of excellence, both academic and athletic. Melissa went on to become the first in her family's history to graduate from college. But this golden era of desegregation was short-lived.
Tuscaloosa has become one of the most rapidly resegregating school districts in the country.
So explained Hannah-Jones on our Democracy Now! NewsHour.
In 2000, when a federal judge released Tuscaloosa from its court order, the school board immediately voted to split up Central. And Central had been created by the court order. In 1979, 25 years after Brown, Tuscaloosa still operated a virtually black high school and a white high school. And so a court forced the merger of those two schools, and they created Central. And it was actually an integration success story. But because of fears of white flight, the board voted in 2000 to split apart that school, and they created three high schools. Two integrated and one that was entirely black.
Here is her key finding, a new kind of segregation. While there are no whites-only schools in Tuscaloosa as there were up until 1979, there is now a struggling blacks-only school, Central High.
The irony of Central High School is Central High School is actually located in an integrated neighborhood, but the white students right across the street from the school are gerrymandered into a district to go to an integrated school. And that Central was created as a black school by the intentional drawing of district lines.
The problem is not limited to the Deep South. UCLA's Civil Rights Project has been tracking national trends. Surprisingly, it found that, quote, New York has the most segregated schools in the country, heavily impacting these state rankings as New York City, home to the largest and one of the most segregated public school systems in the nation, they write. The UCLA report repeatedly uses a term that is now common in academic circles studying resegregation. Apartheid schools, those schools with less than 1% white student enrollment. The report continues, across New York City, 73% of charters were considered apartheid schools and 90% were intensely segregated, less than 10% white enrollment schools in 2010. This week's Supreme Court decision will surely continue the trend of resegregation from high schools into colleges. The 6-2 vote upheld the Michigan ban on race-based affirmative action in state university admissions. Chief Justice John Roberts expressed his feelings about race in 2007 when he controversially said, "The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race." Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissent from the majority this week, wrote, "My colleagues are of the view that we should leave race out of the picture entirely and let the voters sort it out. It is a sentiment out of touch with reality," she said. The reality is, racial discrimination and segregation go hand in hand. Racism may not boom from a governor's podium as it did in 1963 with George Wallace, but a racially divided America can never be equal. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for Jazz in the Afternoon with Jeff Harshbarger.
Hello, everyone. This is Alejandro Escovedo from Austin, Texas, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.